The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.
Good morning and welcome to the Successful Investing Radio Show with me, Jack Monteith, and my business partner, Ken Smith. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Jack. Always a pleasure.
This is a show that is designed to help you build wealth, preserve your wealth, and to enjoy the fruits of your success. Ken and I have a combined 40 years of experience and are partners in the Empirical Wealth Management investment firm. Ken, as you know, our business utilizes the concept of values-based financial planning.
Yeah.
Which leads us to today's interview with Bill Bachrach.
Yeah. And I'll just share a little bit about Bill. Bill is one of the most recognized names in the financial services industry today. He was named one of the four most influential people in the financial services industry by Financial Planning Magazine. As the father of values-based financial planning philosophy and the trusted advisor concept, Bill's work has had a profound impact on how financial professionals conduct business. And he has stood at the forefront of the movement to transform the financial services industry into a true profession. Bill is the author of four of the industry's most definitive works, including Values-Based Financial Planning, which is one of our favorites, Jack, and High Trust Leadership. And he has delivered well over 1,000 presentations worldwide. Before we get into our interview with Bill, I just want to give out our contact information at Empirical. You can reach us Monday through Friday, 8 to 5 p.m. at 1-800-923-4307. That's 1-800-923-4307. Our website address is empiricalwm.com, and Empirical is spelled empiricalwm.com. And if you want to listen to this show, other past shows, and see what's coming up, you can visit our radio website at successfulinvestingradio.com. Successful Investing Radio is all one word.
Great. Well,
let's do it. Well, Bill, Jack and I want to thank you for coming on the show and Successful Investing Radio and being a part of it.
Well, Jack and Ken, it's my pleasure. I appreciate the invitation.
Great. Well, Bill, we've been truly inspired by the work you've done to help individuals and their advisors understand how financial values enhance planning. And we recommend your book, Values-Based Financial Planning, to our clients and our radio listeners. And would you mind sharing with us what inspired you to write this book and explain what values-based financial planning is?
Sure, Ken. I'd be happy to. Well, it all started for me in the mid-1980s when I was a financial advisor, and it was a combination of my professional experience as a financial advisor and also my study of personal development and success principles to learn how people live happy and successful lives. So I believe that money plays a role in success and happiness. Unfortunately, the predominant training in the financial services industry for teaching financial advisors how to get clients is sales training. And sales training tends to be focused on creating fear in people, then making features and benefits presentations about the products and services, handling objections, and then working to close the sale. So the common things that you and your listeners might have heard over the years from financial advisors are things like, you don't plan to fail, you fail to plan. What will happen to your family and your future if you don't save enough? What happens to your assets if you don't invest properly? If I could show you a way to get a higher return on your investments and pay less tax, you'd want to know about it, wouldn't you? And they ask these kind of questions, things like what happens to your family if you die prematurely, painting that beautiful picture of your daughters turning tricks and your wife selling drugs, and kind of that fear-mongering approach.
Right.
And in my day, in the early 80s when I first got into the business, the big fear was inflation. So we were just coming out of a very high inflationary period. Interest rates were very high, and so there was this fear-mongering about what happens if you don't keep up with inflation. It erodes your buying power, which means you can live long and run out of money. How would it make you feel to be a burden on your family or society? And I think we've all been on the wrong end of that kind of fear-mongering. And salespeople call it digging people into a hole and then throwing them a rope. So they ask questions or make statements to scare you, and then shockingly enough, their product or service is the rope to get you out of the hole they just dug you into. Does that sound familiar, Ken?
Yeah, it does, unfortunately.
It's not a very pleasant experience, but that is the predominant type of training that most of us were taught in the financial services industry. The other sales motivator, of course, is greed. You saw it during the internet and the tech boom of the late 90s, and it's rampant among financial advisors who either out-and-out promise or more subtly imply that if you work with them, you'll get a better return. It's that we can beat the market cheerleading, the ultimate salesperson's promise, a higher return but with the same or lower risk. And I don't know about you, but I'm not sure which is more amazing. The fact that financial product salespeople still use these tactics, or the fact that people are still gullible enough to believe them. Maybe P.T. Barnum was right when he said there's a sucker born every minute. You may not be able to tell this from reading my books and my articles, but I'm not known for being especially diplomatic, so let me just say that I think these tactics suck, for lack of a better word.
All right. Well, we appreciate your candor there, Bill.
So to fully answer your question, when I was a young financial advisor, I too was learning and applying these sales tactics, and they do work. I was making money, but I wasn't happy with the proverbial man in the mirror, knowing that my approach to building my business was to make people feel like crap in order to get them to buy my products, or worse, to imply that I could achieve the impossible, which is to beat the market without taking more risk than most people are comfortable with. That being said, you do have to get clients if you're a financial advisor and building your business. So if you can't scare people into becoming clients or appeal to their greed, what do you do? And that was the dichotomy that led me to create values-based financial planning. The answer to the question of how to build a business without sales techniques is to actually do something that's valuable for people, that helps them make smart choices about their money. And the answer to do that is values-based financial planning. And there are plenty of financial advisors like you two who stepped outside of the normal financial services industry sales training and operate this way.
Right.
Many of you have done it on your own, and we've been training financial advisors to be trusted advisors, not salespeople, for just over 20 years now.
Bill, in your book, it seems to be a cornerstone of your concept is answering the question, what's important about money to you? And why is it important to understand that question? And what benefits will an investor derive from this exercise?
Well, Jack, in a word, it's crucial. This is the core question to help people explore their values. And you hear a lot of talk about values, and most of us have an intuitive sense of what's important to us. But to take that and put it on paper, side by side with your spouse's values, is a very powerful exercise from which you will almost immediately begin to make better choices. So not just better financial choices, frankly, but one of the things I've been telling financial advisors for over 20 years is don't be a financial advisor, be a life advisor who specializes in money. So our money choices have an effect on our life. And our values should not only drive our money choices, but really should drive all of our choices in life.
Now, Bill, also in the book, you recommend that the husband and wife go through this exercise separately. Why is that?
Primarily so that your answers aren't influenced by either spouse. So when I say separately, I don't mean that you have to be sequestered into separate rooms or some type of a soundproof booth. I simply mean that you are facilitated up your value staircase, and if you are, in your case, Jack, you'd go up the value staircase completely. And what's your wife's name?
Marlene.
Marlene. And then Marlene would be taken up the value staircase completely. And while you're talking about what's important to you, Marlene, hopefully, would be listening with interest to what's important to you. And if I were facilitating that conversation, then I would make sure that Marlene wasn't able to interrupt you or that she didn't inject her values or what she thinks they are. So it's much more powerful, not just for the person who is moving up the value staircase, but also for the spouse who's listening to hear what their spouse says is important to them.
So, Bill, how do you recommend that people perform this exercise?
Well, in the book Values-Based Financial Planning, there is a very good exercise with instructions that will help people get this done. And it was an effort to really put the exercise in a written form with clear instructions that people could follow. And we know from the tens of thousands of people, actually hundreds of thousands of people who own a copy of Values-Based Financial Planning, we know that it's doable by following the exercise. But really the best way is to have someone with experience facilitate the values conversation, like I just described to Jack. If he and Marlene were, if I were doing this, I would sit each of them down and take each of them up the staircase. So the best way is somebody who has experience doing it to facilitate it, and the next best thing is to follow the instructions in the book.
Gotcha.
Bill, you make a big distinction between values and goals. Could you share with us what the difference between values and goals and why it is important to start with understanding your values first?
Sure, Jack. That's a very good point. Values, in a word or in a few words, are the emotional why behind the goals, and the goals are the tangible what. So values tend to be a little bit more esoteric, philosophical, conceptual, sometimes even a little ethereal, where goals are very tangible. So a goal, for example, a tangible goal is something like retirement or financial independence. You can put a number to a goal, you can put a target date to a goal, you can put some words that describe what a person is thinking and feeling once they achieve that goal. The values behind the goal might be things like having security and freedom and making a difference for my family and feeling a sense of satisfaction and purpose and fulfillment in life. So as you can see or you can hear from the words I'm using, the goals are very tangible and the values are more the emotional why behind the goals. And the reason that you should start with the values is because your values put you in a better frame of mind to accurately define your goals. They help you think a little bit bigger picture about your whole life rather than being in the moment consumed maybe with today's problems. So if you just filled your gas tank and you're unhappy with what that cost you and that is in the forefront of your mind, that's not necessarily the best mindset to be thinking in the big picture about what your long-term goals are.
Great.
Gotcha.
How often do you recommend an individual revisit the question, what's important to you about money?
Well, there are two ways to think about that. One is that it's a good idea to look at and review your values on a regular basis. So I like to look at my values. I have these tools called a financial roadmap and a success roadmap, and I like to look at those at least once a week. It does a couple of things for me. It gets me focused on what's important, so I'm not so consumed with just the day-to-day problems and minutia, and that alters how I choose to spend my time, which has an effect on the quality of my life. It also helps inspire me. I don't know about you guys, but there are some days that are better than others. There are some days when I feel like doing the things that I need to do to have the life that I want, and there are days when I don't feel like it. And so it's easy to get motivated to do what needs to be done on the days when you do feel like it, a little harder on the days when you don't. So I find by reflecting on what's important to me and looking at my goals, it has an effect on how I choose to invest my time. So my day is better, which makes my week better, which makes my life better. The other, maybe what's implied in your question is, should the values be reevaluated or should you redo a values clarification exercise? And the answer is you rarely have to do that. For the most part, our values don't change. Our values have been ingrained in us for a very, very long time. So when you do a values clarification exercise or a value staircase on a financial roadmap, they just rarely change. What can happen is in a particular period of your life, one of your values may become accentuated. So, for example, if you're moving through your life, as most of us normally are, and somebody close to you or you have some kind of an illness or some kind of an event that brings focus on that particular value, you'll be focused on that value for that period of time. But once your life gets back to normal, for lack of a better word, then values tend to realign as they've always been. So redoing the exercise is something that rarely needs to be done, if ever.
Bill, this is Jack. I'll just finish with one small comment on that. You know, really, I just had an aha moment, because now I can see the great tool of using this and determining what your values are. You know, you said you revisit it on a weekly basis. I can see where you can kind of use that as a tool to kind of recenter, you know, your vision and what's important to you. So great answer. Thank you.
And Bill, I just want to follow up on that. We're talking about, do values change? But you obviously, as the inventor of this, have done it a lot more than we have. And I'm curious, do you find that in a husband and wife situation or a couple, that they learn a lot about each other after they perform this exercise?
Ken, that is huge. In fact, I didn't invent the idea that values have an effect on human behavior and that values drive our choices in life. What I did is I packaged it in a financial services format, because that's my background.
Gotcha.
But you really hit the nail on the head in my process of trying to figure this out, because in the mid-1980s, when I was, as I mentioned, unfortunately, initially a student of sales techniques, I realized that, boy, I really don't want to sell people things. I want to help them make good choices. So in my study of what helps people make good choices, there was a lot written about your values. And I experimented a lot. I thought, how do I bring this discussion about what's important to people into a discussion with a financial advisor, because they're not really used to that. Most of your listeners on this show probably think in terms of, well, you talk to your advisor about what's going on in the economy, or what's going to happen in the market, or what happens depending on who is the president, or which party is in Congress, and everybody's trying to second guess and beat the market. So when I started doing this in the mid-80s, it was odd. It was uncomfortable for me, and I think it was uncomfortable for some of my clients and prospective clients who I was experimenting with. But what motivated me to carry on and to continue to do it was exactly what you described. It was these huge bonding moments between spouses. It was sitting down with couples in their 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and having them look at each other and say things like, wow. I mean, intuitively, they knew it was important to their husband or wife, but to have that wow moment and go, I've never heard you phrase it that way.
Right.
To be able to, I mean, I'm sitting here telling you the stories, having reflection. I'm getting goosebumps telling the stories. and I remember actually seeing them. You could see them physically. You could see the hair on their arms raise up as they got goose flesh. You could see their eyes well up with tears as they had these incredibly bonding experiences. From my point of view as a financial advisor, and I think this is valuable for you too as well as for your listeners, is it also told me a lot about the couple. Let's face it, half of marriages, unfortunately, end up in divorce. Money is a big issue. One of the things that I discovered from having values conversations with couples is it flushed out fairly quickly whether or not these two people actually get along.
Right.
And you know, if a couple doesn't get along, if they don't have some commonality in their values, more importantly, if they don't respect each other's values. So my wife Ann and I don't have exactly the same values, but I like to think that we have a respect for each other's differences. So what you find sometimes when you have a values conversation, and those of you listening and who are going to invest in the book and try this at home, pay attention to, does your spouse try and manipulate your values? Is your spouse really interested in hearing what's important to you, or are they more interested in telling you what ought to be important to you, because that's what's important to them? So there have been some, you're right, I've done this thousands and thousands of times and trained thousands of advisors and heard the stories from them, and it's that most of the time a powerful positive experience But when it's not, it's something to pay attention to.
Right, right. It's probably a good exercise before people get married to.
It probably is, but you know, at the end of the day, I'm not a therapist.
Right.
I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not qualified to do either of those things.
Yeah.
But if a couple doesn't get along and can't somehow figure out a way to make decisions in harmony, it will affect their ability to achieve their goals, and it'll affect their happiness.
Right. Well, I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, Bill. In your book, you mentioned that there are three types of people as it relates to professional help and how they choose to receive that or not. Would you share with us the three types and describe their characteristics?
Sure, Ken. I think you're referring to the do-it-yourselfer, the collaborator, and the delegator. Is that right?
Right. That's how you divided it.
So the term do-it-yourselfer is fairly self-explanatory. I once saw a TV commercial for do-it-yourselfer financial services firm that featured a man, and if you can visualize this, he's kicked back in his beach chair on the end of his dock, and there's a big yacht in the background. And he folds his hands behind his head, and he says, "Why would I pay someone else to do what I could do for myself?" And that's the mantra of the do-it-yourselfer. Do-it-yourselfers tend to value money over time. Or they may have trust issues. You hear do-it-yourselfers say things like, if you want something done right, you have to do it yourself.
Right.
Do-it-yourselfers also tend to get gratification from figuring things out and doing things themselves. If you're ever stranded on a desert island, you would want to be there with a long-time do-it-yourselfer. The delegator has exactly the opposite point of view. If the delegator was sitting on the end of that same dock, their mantra would be, why would I do anything myself that I could pay someone else to do? So the delegator tends to value time over money. They like having experts tell them what to do, and if you're going to pay an expert to tell you what to do, then you might as well follow their advice.
Right.
I mean, what's the point of paying for advice if you're not going to follow it? So delegators seem to like the simplicity and the less time-consuming nature of paying for expert advice and following it. One of my favorite experiences, I've given a lot of speeches over the years to financial advisors, some to consumers, but more to financial advisors. And Peter Lynch, the famous manager of the Fidelity Magellan Fund, and I were both making presentations at a conference in the early 90s. I think it was 93, 94. And the audience of financial advisors was a little skeptical about Fidelity's intentions to create relationships with advisors when Fidelity had been so successful building a consumer-direct business with no-load mutual funds. And Peter Lynch was smart to address their concerns in the beginning of his speech. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but the essence of his remarks were that the Magellan Fund, to that point in time, had delivered a 16% average annual return. However, the typical investor in the Magellan Fund only achieved a 2% return. So how is that the case? How is it that the fund was delivering 16% a year and the investors in the fund were only getting 2% a year? Well, according to Peter Lynch, the majority of Magellan Fund investors were getting a poor return because they were trying to market time the fund by moving in and out and essentially making the classic mistake, buying high and selling low. He told the audience that Fidelity's research indicated that clients who have a good advisor don't play that game. Therefore, they actually get the return the fund delivers, in this case, a 14% positive swing. And that's why Fidelity wanted to work with advisors. He had their attention,
right.
And that's the benefit of being a financial delegator. So I think the delegator appreciates that the advisor may not be any smarter than he is, but the advisor is more objective and can help the client make very important decisions at crucial times when those decisions may be counterintuitive. And the third person that you asked about is the collaborator. And the collaborator is in between the delegator and the do-it-yourselfer. They don't have expertise to know everything they need to know to be their own financial advisor, but they struggle to really completely let it go and follow an advisor's advice. So the collaborator tends to have several advisors, maybe none of whom they especially trust, But they end up getting options from these different advisors. They do some of their own homework, and ultimately they make their own decision. And Ken and Jack, I don't believe there's an absolute right or wrong to being a do-it-yourselfer, a delegator, a collaborator. I do personally have a bit of a bias toward delegation because I happen to be a person who values time over money. And the reason is because there's so many things in my life that can't be delegated that I want to do. So I look for areas where I can delegate, which frees up more time. There are only 168 hours in the week. Some of them are sleeping, some of them are eating, some of them are taking care of hygiene, showering, brushing your teeth. So with that limited amount of time, I tend to prefer to delegate. So it's an individual choice. I think every listener, everybody has to decide what works better for them.
Well, that makes sense.
Bill, you do you believe that most individuals should be delegating to professional advisors? And what would an individual need to know about investments, financial planning, and behavioral finance in order to match the value added by a good financial professional?
Yeah, you know, Jack, it's a good question. It's a tricky one. So I'll answer it this way. It depends. I think delegation is worth trying. But some people are simply not willing to adjust their mindset or their behavior to delegate. There are some people that, at the end of the day, just really don't trust anybody. And delegation requires trust. I'll talk a little bit more about how you can find somebody you trust. But I don't know about you guys, but if you've ever met somebody, and maybe we all have a family member or a friend that would fall into the category of don't trust anybody. And in the extreme, it's paranoia. In the extreme, it's conspiracy theory. Although, what's that old joke? I'm not paranoid if they're really out to get me. I really do think there are huge benefits to delegating, but I also appreciate that the term control freak didn't come about by accident. So I would just propose that when I'm talking to a friend who doesn't delegate much in their life, and this is more than just money. I mean, you can delegate and have somebody clean your house, thus freeing you to do something more important. You can delegate to someone else to change the oil in your car, so it frees you to do something that's more important. You can delegate a lot of things in life. It's not just about money. So I would propose when I'm talking to a friend that they explore what is it that could be delegated to make room for something that's more important. The challenge is that there are so many things that are important, but at the end of the day, you can't change the fact that there are only 168 hours in the week. And this is my personal development background coming out when I say your quality of life is a function of how you choose to spend your limited time. So money is something that can be delegated. It's important. It's more important than who you hire to clean your house, but it can be delegated. So I think the second part of your question, Jack, was how do you find a good financial advisor and what should you know to be able to make a good choice about the advisor? Did I get that right?
That's right.
Yeah, I think so. Bill, from reading your books, I mean, I'm convinced that, you know, whether someone's a do-it-yourselfer or a collaborator or a delegator, you know, the concept in your book, you know, equally applies to each.
Well, I would agree with that. I think having a financial roadmap, knowing what your values are, I mean, we wrote values-based financial planning so that not just the clients of advisors that we've trained could get the benefit of that. We wrote
right.
that so everybody could get the benefit of it. And there's no question that having a financial roadmap that's based on your values, having a comprehensive plan that's based on your values and your goals is beneficial for anyone. So I agree with you. I think it's good for anybody to answer your question about, well, if you're thinking about hiring an advisor or exploring the advisor path, what would be a good path for that? So I'll just tell you what I tell my friends. I get this question from my friends a lot. Bill, you've been a financial advisor. You train financial advisors. You have a lot of experience with advisors. How do I find a good one? There are basically two elements to making a good choice before hiring an advisor. One is I recommend that you only work with someone who was referred by someone you trust. Now, this, of course, becomes difficult if you don't trust anybody, but hopefully you have someone out there who you trust. It could be a friend. It could be a mentor. It could be a colleague. It could be another advisor you do business with, like a lawyer or an accountant, or it could be your dentist. It could be a real estate professional. It could be a mortgage broker. But somebody who you have a relationship with where you trust them. You believe that if they're working with this person, that says something to you. And for some people, that's enough. For some people, if you say, boy, if you've been working with Jack and Ken for 10 years, that's good enough for me. For others, you might want to take it to the next level, which is to do a more thorough background check. And for a couple hundred dollars, you can hire a professional to do this, or you can do it yourself online. Ken and Jack, you two were kind enough to give me some insights in advance about some of the questions you were going to ask. So in preparation for this question, I simply went to Google and I entered background check for financial advisor. And I got a nice list of resources from regulatory agencies and governing bodies that make it easy to check out a financial advisor. So those are a couple things you could do in advance. But my answer is a little bigger than just what to do in advance, because then it gets personal. When you have your face-to-face meeting or when you're talking to an advisor on the phone who you might want to hire, what about chemistry? What about just a sense of synergy and chemistry? One of my mentors calls it simpatico. Do you have a feeling of simpatico? Do they ask good questions and listen? This is huge in my opinion. Most advisors want to sit you down and impress you with how much they know. The great advisors ask really good questions, and this is huge. Do they make silly, we can beat the market promises? Do you recognize that a promise like that is silly? Do they help you build a picture of your future and inspire you to make good choices to have that future? Or do they resort to old-fashioned sales techniques to scare you or guilt you into planning or working with them? I mean, when you walk out of this person's office, you and your spouse should feel inspired. On the way to your car, you should say, we're going to get it done. There are about 100 things that need to be done in order to declare yourself financially successful, in order to say, my financial house is in order. Do you feel inspired by your advisor to get those things done, or do you feel like they're manipulating you? Another couple of things that may be valuable is, how many clients do they have? I mean, the rule of 168 applies to all of us personally and professionally. One advisor really can't work with more than about 100 clients. I'm always surprised how many advisors don't seem to be able to do the math about how their time could be spread among their clients and how many they can really serve. So those are a few things that I would recommend.
That's great. Very powerful.
Bill, what characteristics should a financial professional possess before you would recommend that an individual work with that advisor?
Well, I tell my friends to look for an astute business person with a servant's heart. If they're ruled too much by their servant's heart, they won't know how or when to say no, and they'll end up with too many clients to effectively serve. In this case, they can burn out or go broke, or both. If the business person mindset takes over completely, they might be a bit too mercenary about acquiring clients and servicing their clients, and they may treat you more like client number 42 than Ken or Jack. A combination of business savvy and a sincere desire to help you achieve your goals and fulfill your values is best. So you want somebody who cares, who's successful in their business. I always remind financial advisors that people who give others financial advice are supposed to be financially successful. I mean, you wouldn't want to have a broke financial advisor. That would be like having a dentist without teeth. So you might want to find out a little bit about their business. Are they successful, and do they care? And that's a good combination of characteristics in a financial advisor.
Okay.
Good point.
Bill, are you looking for someone, or should an individual be looking for someone that is an expert in all fields, like financial planning, investing, insurance, and tax, or someone that's more of a team-oriented, takes a team-oriented approach to services?
Well, I have a bias toward the team-oriented approach. When I'm talking to my friends, I tell them that today the best financial advisors have a deliverables team. There was a time when financial advisors positioned themselves as someone with expertise in financial planning, investing, the many different types of insurance, plus a little knowledge about tax and legal issues like estate planning. I call that the old school know-it-all financial advisor. As I mentioned, today the best financial advisors have a deliverables team of what we refer to as subject matter experts. That means the financial planner writes the plan. The full-time professional money managers handle the investments. Insurance experts from many different disciplines of insurance provide insurance advice. Qualified tax experts give the tax advice, the same for the legal advice, and so on. If you can envision this, the advisor or planner operates more like an orchestra conductor to be sure the client is fully served. So most people are paying for all this anyway. It's just not very well coordinated. You might have noticed that the orchestra conductor does not sit in any of the chairs or play an instrument. The same would be true for the quarterback. The quarterback doesn't also do the blocking. So the best financial advisors today have a team of experts to help their clients achieve their goals.
So, Bill, how does delegating to the right advisor enhance the ability for an individual to have more life fulfillment in spite of what stock and bond markets are doing?
Well, I believe, Ken, that the most important element to delegating to an advisor is having an advisor who holds you accountable to implement the advice of the experts on their deliverables team. A good financial advisor will hold you accountable to do what needs to be done, whether you feel like it or not, and regardless of your emotional reaction to the market, the economy, or world events. So typically, we are our own worst enemy when it comes to achieving our goals and doing the things that need to be done. And it's easy to recognize that in hindsight. What we need in our lives, in my opinion, and I'm a big fan of being mentored and coached. So I have a lot of mentors and a lot of coaches. I've had many of them over the years that have helped me in various areas of my life to be successful. So I'm very biased to this subject of accountability. I've been fortunate to have people in my life who tell me what I need to hear, not what I want to hear. You hear that about good leaders. Good leaders don't want to be surrounded by proverbial yes men or yes people. They want people who challenge them and tell them what they need to hear, not what they want to hear. So I believe that's very important when you are delegating to a financial advisor. Part of knowing that you can trust them is to know that they're not just kissing your butt to tell you what you want to hear so that they can keep your money. You want to have somebody who's willing to risk the relationship by telling you the truth. And of course, you and your advisor will focus on what you can control. Life is better when you focus on what you can control than when you get distracted by what you can't. I recently hired a professional speaker and psychologist to speak at our Values-Based Financial Planning Academy, and he describes this as maturity. Maturity is when you recognize that your life is better when you focus on what you can control, and immaturity is when you blame external events for your circumstances. So it's really pretty simple. Your behavior, consistently applied over time, is what determines whether or not you achieve your goals in life. Those are your financial goals and all your goals. Contrary to popular opinion, successful people were seldom just in the right place at the right time. Successful people make their own luck. So when you read the backstory of the so-called overnight success, you discover a long period of work preceded the so-called overnight success. And that's how you achieve a goal. The same is true for you and me. We all live through many ups and downs in the market, the economy, and the world. The choices that make people successful have not changed since the beginning of time, and that's true for money as anything else. So one of the big benefits of being a delegator is you have said to your advisor, I will follow your advice. Please tell me the truth. Hold me accountable to what my wife and I need to do so we can achieve our goals. I made up a little saying about 20 years ago, and I made it up for myself, and I found other people have gotten benefit from it. Failing with an excuse is not as good as succeeding, even a really good excuse.
Right.
Well,
a good advisor will not let you make excuses. He or she will hold you accountable to do what needs to be done.
It sounds like, Bill, your advice, and we've come as advisors, Jack and I come across this, where clients want us to do things sometimes that we know is not in their best financial interest, like pulling out of the market.
Right.
And your advice, I think, would be you want an advisor who's not going to acquiesce to that.
That's absolutely true. In fact, feel so strongly about it that they would say to you, if you're the client, they would say, I can't do that. If you want that to be done, you have to fire me as your advisor and have that done by somebody else. I can't do it. I will not do something that is not in your best interest. And that's your job. Your job, in my opinion, Ken and Jack, is to protect your clients from making stupid choices.
Right.
What does the term fiduciary mean? You have a fiduciary obligation to tell your clients the truth. And if they fire you and move the money, fine. Ultimately, it's their prerogative.
Right.
Ultimately, it's your money. It's your decision whose advice you take and whose advice you don't take. But I don't have any axe to grind here. I'm not a financial advisor anymore. I don't have any. You can't call me up and try to hire me to be a financial advisor. But I have a financial advisor. And I can tell you, my financial advisor holds me just as accountable. In fact, my financial advisor has the benefit of hearing me say things like this.
That's great.
So when I find myself, or my wife finds herself, where we're going, when we're uncomfortable with something, our financial advisor just smiles and says, "Yeah, this is one of those times to walk your talk, Mr. and Mrs. Backrack."
That's great. That's great.
You know, so are you going to follow the advice, or are you firing me today?
Powerful stuff, Bill.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, you provide readers with a financial roadmap, and in fact, I believe that advisors and individual investors can order this roadmap from your company. But will you share the purpose of having a financial roadmap with our listeners?
Absolutely. I love the financial roadmap. I mean, the financial roadmap is such a great tool because having a good life is all about making smart choices. And I wish I could take credit for the roadmap. I say I love the roadmap, and you might be listening going, well, duh, you invented it. Of course you love it. But the truth is that it was one of my financial service firm corporate clients who inspired me to create the roadmap. So I was using the values conversation and the goals conversation and the all the money conversation, the different elements of the financial roadmap, and I was just writing it on separate pieces of paper. And when this company hired me to create a customized version of values-based financial planning for their firm, they said, you know, it would be really helpful. It'd be really helpful if we had a visual tool to put this all into perspective. And I said, well, like what do you mean? And Dave, the corporate executive at this company, said, well, I mean like a roadmap. And so we put our graphic artist on it, and we came up with this roadmap. And I have to be honest with you, my first reaction to it was, well, that's nice, but it's not really necessary. I mean, three pieces of paper will work just as good as this roadmap. And then the results started coming in, and the reviews from the advisors and clients started coming in, and they were loving the roadmap, and they were getting better results. So I became a roadmap convert, and I love the roadmap. So having a good life is all about making smart choices. And the first step to making good choices in life or about money is to be clear about your values. Roy Disney said, Roy Disney, by the way, is Walt Disney's brother. He said, when your values are clear, your decisions are easy. And this is the first element of the financial roadmap. So if you can picture in your mind this big 17 by 22 piece of paper, and up in the upper right-hand section, there are two staircases. And those are the value staircases, and you and your wife's, or you and your husband's, or you and your partner's values will be side by side on those staircases. The second element of the financial roadmap is to specifically define your goals. And what I mean by that is each goal has a name that inspires you. For example, some people are inspired by the term retirement, and other people cringe at the term retirement. So you don't want to let some financial advisor force retirement planning on you. If your goal is retirement and that inspires you, great. Other people don't like the term retirement. They like financial independence or they like financial freedom. So it's not just a question of semantics. It's having the names on your roadmap of goals that inspire you. And each goal should have a target date and a specific amount of money required to achieve it, and some compelling words that describe what you're thinking, feeling once you've achieved that goal. And the third element of the financial roadmap, if you can envision in the lower left-hand quadrant of this big creative piece of paper, is the truth. And the truth is you have to be honest with yourself about where you are now. So exactly how much money do you have? Exactly how much debt do you have? Exactly how much insurance do you have in the various categories of insurance? No exaggeration, no spin, no hyperbole, no embellishment, an absolutely honest assessment of your current reality. As they say in golf, you can't paint a picture on your scorecard. The only thing that fits in that little box is a number. So you have to be really honest with yourself about where you are financially, compare that to your goals and to what's important to you, and now you have the basis for creating a comprehensive financial plan that, when implemented, will help you actualize your financial roadmap. It's a big, colorful visual tool that puts these things in perspective, so you have a higher probability of consistently doing over time what's required to achieve your goals for your reasons. And when it comes to money, we just call this process values-based financial planning, and that's what we train financial professionals to do. Or as an individual, you can follow the process and the exercises in the book and put it together yourself.
Bill, how can our listeners get in touch with you and your company?
Well, the easiest thing to do is just to go to our website. You can go to, there are multiple ways to get to our website. You can go through my name, www.billbackrack.com. Backrack, not quite like Bert. He has an A between the back and the rack. It's Bill, BACHRACH.com. If it's easier, just type in www.valuesbasedfinancialplanning.com. That'll take you to our website. If you're a financial advisor, then you can explore our site to learn more about values-based financial planning and how you can use this process with your clients to build what we call an ideal client community. If you are an individual, then you can go to the investments tab on the left-hand side of the screen, investments tab, and that'll take you to where you can buy a copy of values-based financial planning. If you want a copy of values-based financial planning, you can all just go to Amazon.com and buy it there. And that's what I would suggest would be a good start.
Great.
That's
thanks,
great,
Bill. What resources do you have available for financial advisors and individuals?
Well, for individuals, it's primarily the values-based financial planning book. And for financial advisors, for those who like values-based financial planning, like you two who read the book and said, wow, this is really great, we have a 2 to 4 year curriculum. So things like implementing a successful process like values-based financial planning, contrary to popular belief, there's no silver bullet. So it's a 2 to 4 year curriculum for transforming your business from a traditional model to having an ideal client community of people implementing values-based financial planning. We have a team of accountability coaches who shepherd financial advisors through the process of self-study, training, and personal coaching until you have a finite number of ideal clients. The first step is to schedule an appointment to get a tool we call the Success Roadmap done. So just like individuals would have a financial roadmap for their personal financial life, business owners and financial advisors or business owners can use a tool called the Success Roadmap to do something similar in their business. So we're fairly easy to find. If you're serious about finding us, you can find us, and there's certainly lots of information on our website to learn more.
Well, Bill, Ken and I, as we've said, we're huge fans of this approach, and we've implemented it into our business. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, it's a great approach for someone that wants to really focus on what's important in their life and achieve financial goals, but it also takes work. And so, you know, for someone that's really, and an advisor or an individual investor, somebody that's willing to invest in themselves with the time and effort to do this, I mean, I really believe they'll see tremendous dividends as a result.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. There's an old saying, the only place where success comes before work is in the dictionary. And that's why it's good to have mentors and coaches and people like you guys who can help facilitate people through the process. I don't know about you, but I'm a lot more likely to exercise when my trainer is coming to the house. I'm a lot more likely to go for the bike ride when five of my friends are expecting me to be there because I made a commitment to do it.
Right.
So there's a saying I believe in, that nobody succeeds alone. So whether it's by reading books and following the advice, or whether it's by having mentors and coaches and advisors, there are people who have been further along this journey than you and I have been, who are happy to help us with the next leg of the journey. And my general advice is that your quality of life is in your hands, and don't let events that are out of your control dictate your success and happiness.
Well, that's great.
Powerful stuff, Bill. And Ken and I could go on with questions and comments indefinitely. So, I mean, we'd love to, at sometime in the future, have you back. It's been a great experience for us in our business and our existing clients, and we highly recommend your books and approach.
Yeah, thank you very much, Bill.
Well, you're welcome, gentlemen. It was my pleasure. It's an honor to be on your show.
Thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, Ken, that about does it for this show. Time really flies.
Sure does.
So before we retire to the pool, why don't you tell our listeners about our upcoming guest and some contact information for us.
Sure. You can reach us at Empirical Monday through Friday at 1-800-923-4307. That's 1-800-923-4307 if you have any questions about the show, or you're just interested in meeting us and looking at Empirical as an option to be your financial advisor. We encourage you to give us a call. You can visit our website at Empirical, EmpiricalWM.com. And to listen to this show, other past shows, and see what's coming, you can visit our radio website at SuccessfulInvestingRadio.com. And coming up in one of our shows, we're going to have Professor Robert Shiller, a multi-book author, and his recent book is The Subprime Solution, How Today's Global Financial Crisis Happened and What to Do About It. So that'll be an exciting show you want to tune in for.
Now, that's a very timely topic. So until next week, have a great day.
Have a great week.
The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided, and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.